Legal Face-Off on WGNRadio.com is brought to you by McCorkle Litigation Services, leaders in court reporting and legal technology.
Hey, what's up, y'all? It's your man Montel Jordan, and this is how we do it. And right now, you're listening to Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. That's right, you're locked onto the high-energy legal podcast with lawyers Rich Lenkov and Tina Martini, and they're going to be trading jabs on the breaking news and the hottest issues, sports, entertainment, politics. Nothing is off limits. Keep listening, because this is how we do it.
Welcome to another edition of Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. We have Tina Martini of Deckert and Rich Lenkov from Downey Lenkov. I'm your moderator, Ryan Burrow. Actor Timothy Busfield's career continues to take a hit as this ongoing sexual abuse case continues to unfold despite support from his wife, Melissa Gilbert. He's been recast on Law & Order, SVU. We got the indictment. David Ring is an attorney based out of L.A. with Taylor Ring. He's represented children and adults who have suffered sexual abuse cases against schools, churches, youth organizations, other institutions. Over 30 years he's been at work at this. Thanks so much for joining us, Dave.
Thank you for having me.
So, Dave, as Ryan mentioned last Friday, actor and director Timothy Busfield was indicted by a grand jury in New Mexico on four counts of criminal sexual contact of a child. The charges stem from allegations brought by child actors with whom he worked on the set of the series The Cleaning Lady in 2022 and 2023. He was originally taken into custody last month on two counts of criminal sexual contact of a minor and one count of child abuse. Please tell us more about this latest development with Timothy Busfield.
You know, this grand jury indictment is obviously a very significant development in the case. It means the prosecutors went before the grand jury, presented their evidence, and the grand jurors decided amongst themselves that there's enough evidence for this criminal allegations to go to a trial. And that means Timothy Busfield is facing a trial on very serious child abuse charges. If he were convicted, he would be facing, you know, several years in prison.
Now, you know, you deal with these kind of cases and you deal with the responses of defendants. He has said that there's evidence that his victims, alleged victims, allegations were manufactured, retaliatory. I think he said that, you know, a couple of victims were upset because their roles were cut or something to do with, you know, a work decision. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, this is where this case has gotten very interesting. Busfield and his lawyers have come out of the gate swinging. I mean, with a very aggressive defense. They've essentially called these boys and their parents liars. And really, I think it's based upon three things that they're really going to attack in this case. They're going to say that these boys who were 7 or 8 years old when this happened, and this is only a couple years ago, so they're still young, that they're saying these boys were coached, that they were coached to make up these allegations against Busfield, that they are coached by adults, whether it's parents or someone else. The other part that's interesting is Busfield's claiming that this is done out of revenge, that these allegations are fabricated to get back at him for not having these boys on this show for the last season, and that the parents have orchestrated this whole thing. And then finally, the third thing is Busfield's really going after this family and these parents. And he's, you know, the father has a checkered past, been convicted of wire fraud. And Busfield's saying this is all fraudulent, it's made up, and it's a money grab.
So Dave, as you said, Busfield's legal team is coming out swinging. And as part of that, they've submitted more than 70 letters from people vouching for Busfield's character. And they've also highlighted that he passed an independent polygraph test. How should these be evaluated from an evidentiary standpoint?
So the 70 letters of support, those were submitted to the court as part of a detention hearing that took place a few weeks ago. And the detention hearing was basically to decide if Busfield was going to stay in jail the entire time leading up to his trial. And those 70 letters of support obviously were very successful in work because the judge did not hold him to stay in jail while these charges are pending. He released him on his own recognizance. So that's where the 70 letters of support came into play. Very important. Now, the other thing you mentioned, this lie detector test, is fascinating because, you know, most of us out there think, you know, we've heard a lie detector test, but we don't, we've been told they're not admissible. They never come into a criminal case. Well, guess what? New Mexico is one of the rare exceptions where a lie detector test can be used in a criminal case. And so, look, we don't know much about the lie detector test. We don't know who administered it, their qualifications, the questions that were asked, but let's assume it was done validly and properly, and that Busfield was asked, did you molest these boys? And his answer was, no, I didn't. And he passed that test, and that's admissible as criminal trial. That is a really, really powerful tool for the criminal defense of that case.
Dave, Warner Brothers said that they conducted their own investigation independent, and they found no evidence to support these claims. Number one, do you believe that? Number two, how relevant would that be to this case? And, you know, I think anyone would understand that they are probably concerned for their own liability as well, right? I mean, maybe not criminal liability, although there's that potential, but more likely civil liability for Warner Brothers, especially in the middle of a sale, that's got to be on their mind, right?
Exactly right. So look, it's not unusual for employers to hire attorneys or independent company to do an investigation of sexual harassment or sexual assault. And that's what Warner Brothers did. They hired someone to look into this. Again, the issue that we have, or the problem that we have, is we know the result. What we don't know is, well, who did they interview? And there's reports out there that the two boys did not provide interviews to the Warner Brothers investigator, and neither did their parents. So it's a bit of a one-sided investigation. That doesn't mean it's a bad investigation. It's just they investigated what they could. I think the important takeaway from the Warner Brothers investigation is that they did interview a lot of people on the set, actors, production people, and all of those people said they never saw anything unusual or improper by Busfield towards these boys. So that goes a long way, that there's going to be a lot of witnesses out there that say they saw nothing unusual. Does the report itself ever come into the criminal trial? Probably not.
So, Dave, as often happens in these kinds of cases, there are also multiple alleged incidents beyond these accusations for which Busfield ended up not being charged, but these allegations go back to the 1990s. What weight, if any, should these allegations be given under the circumstances?
This is where it gets very messy for Timothy Busfield, because there are two allegations made against him, and they do date back 20, 25 years, but they're important. Both of them relate to teenage girls. The first one, a 16-year-old girl who was like in a theater play with him, claimed that he actually put his hand down her pants and sexually molested her. And if you believe the reports, the dad came out recently and said that back then when it happened, Busfield begged him not to go to the police, and Busfield promised to get therapy for what had happened. And the dad went along with that. And then when the dad heard about this most recent allegation, came forward and said, hey, he did this to my daughter 25 years ago. The other one is a 17-year-old girl who was on a movie set with Busfield back in the 1990s, and again says that he made sexual passes at her and improperly touched her. That resulted in a civil settlement. Again, no criminal charges on either one of those. However, if the judge in this New Mexico case involving these two boys, if that judge decides somehow that these two prior incidents come into play and the jury gets to hear about them, that is bad news for Timothy Busfield. That is really going to hurt his position, because he obviously has some problems in the past with this.
And that would come in under a pattern argument, like an MO argument, right? Explain how that works, because we saw that most famously in the Bill Cosby case, that this modus operandi evidence was allowed to come in. Why does that come in, and how does that play out?
That's exactly right. And so, look, every state has a different law on this, but a lot of the states, they basically, in sexual assault cases, and especially child sexual assault cases, prior victims are very important. and to exclude them entirely is just not fair. And so it comes in under an evidence code that allows for an MO, a particular type of behavior by the defendant in the past, along the same lines that he's being accused of it in the present time, so that those other victims can come in and basically say, he did it to me as well. He has a pattern for doing this.
Dave, I got one last question. You know, you've represented many clients against high profile individuals. You represented Jane Doe 1 in the Harvey Weinstein case, among, you know, many high profile cases. We just discussed, or we will be discussing, I should say, the Harvey Weinstein release with one of your colleagues on your side who also represents victims. How does representing clients against a high-profile individual like a Jeffrey Epstein, like a Harvey Weinstein, like a Timothy Busfield, how does that affect your strategy? Does it make it easier? Does it make it harder? Talk to us about some of the unique attributes of that kind of case.
I think it makes it a lot more difficult, and it's really the reason why is most of these high-profile defendants, they have assets and they have money, and they can hire some of the best criminal defense lawyers you can find. And their job, those criminal defense lawyers, their job is to do anything and everything to win the case for their client. And that makes it really difficult. I've seen some of these victims just put through horrendous things by high-powered defendants who have a lot of money and can pay their attorneys no matter what it takes. So that's the biggest hurdle. But again, you know, if you get to that trial, it's an even playing field in that courtroom, and the truth usually comes out.
David Ring, thank you so much for joining us today on Legal Face-Off.
Thank you.
Rich Lenkoff is an attorney with Downey & Lenkoff, a firm with offices in Illinois, Indiana, and Wisconsin. Rich is consistently recognized by clients like McDonald's, Target, Macy's, Wendy's, and the Chicago Bears for his zealous advocacy and outstanding litigation results. Rich's many accolades include being named as an Illinois Super Lawyer from 2015 to present and leading lawyer from 2012 to present. These are designations given to less than 5% of Illinois attorneys. Rich is also an active member of his community, serving on the Legal Prep Charter Academy Advisory Board and the Northern Illinois University College of Law Board of Visitors. Rich is also a producer with credits including 85, The Greatest Team in Football History, starring Barack Obama, Bill Murray, and Mike Ditka. Renegades, a Caesar's Palace production starring Terrell Owens, Jose Canseco, and Jim McMahon, Rock of Ages, and Elvis Presley's Heartbreak Hotel in concert. In addition to hosting WGN's Legal Face-Off since 2014, Rich serves as a legal analyst for a variety of media outlets. Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service litigation firm practicing general liability, workers' compensation, professional malpractice, and intellectual property, among other practice areas. For more information about Rich and Downey & Lenkoff, please visit dl-firm.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off with Rich Lenkoff and Tina Martini. I'm Ryan Burrow. Ghislaine Maxwell, the former girlfriend and longtime confidant of Jeffrey Epstein, invoked the Fifth Amendment when brought in to testify before a congressional committee today. Lawmakers were hoping a deposition could finally answer some of the unanswered questions surrounding Epstein. Meanwhile, one of the Epstein accusers says she was improperly named in the release of documents by the Department of Justice, called the DOJ's handling of the case egregious. Joining us today on Legal Face-Off, Eric Vidali, a partner and managing attorney at the Bloom Firm in New York City. In 2011, he began exclusively representing survivors of sexual abuse and civil lawsuits, fighting for the rights of victims across the country. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Eric, so how many victims of Epstein do you represent? How many victims were released in this document dump? Let's start there and then tell us why you feel so strongly about what happened.
Yeah, so I represent I represent 11 survivors of Jeffrey Epstein. Okay. And two of them were named in this latest release, despite the DOJ having both of their names. One of my clients, her name was revealed in the latest release 538 times, which is just an egregious amount of times when the DOJ already had her name, knew she was a survivor who should have been redacted. We, of course, the other client was named five times. We, of course, immediately informed the DOJ. Took them a few days. They got it down to two for one of the clients. Eventually, they're both now completely removed from the website. But, you know, one would have been too many times. 538 is just it's nonsensical. It's baffling.
So the DOJ blamed this on technical errors. They said there were so many pages. They said it was human error. I mean, are we buying any of this? I mean, do you think it was incompetence? Do you think it was purposeful, a combination of the two? What's your feeling on this answer they gave?
I've been struggling with that for the last, you know, couple of weeks or so. Is this sheer incompetence? Is this intentional? What's clear is it's just a disregard for the well-being of the survivors. You know, they've been very proficient when it came to redacting the names of potential abusers, suspicious names and very emails mentioning victims, that sort of thing. You know, they didn't seem to make a lot of mistakes there, but certainly when it came to the survivors, they made a lot of mistakes. I've heard a lot of stories about a lot of other survivors being named. It's not just my clients. So I don't know if it's intentional, it's incompetence. I think it's just a disregard for the well-being of the survivors, and that's been consistent throughout the last few decades with the Department of Justice is how they've treated these survivors.
And why do your survivors, at the risk of asking, you know, a dumb question, why do your survivors want to remain anonymous?
Well, it's a deep question, but I'll do my best to answer. So one thing that I think is underreported about Jeffrey Epstein is the amount of fear and intimidation he instilled in his victims. He would threaten them. He would threaten their lives. He would threaten their families' lives. And I think people don't realize how truly evil he was in that regard and how much that stayed with many of the survivors. I've had clients tell me, you know, they still have four alarms on their house. When they turn out the lights at night, you know, they still see Jeffrey Epstein outside their window. They still live in fear of Jeffrey Epstein and his, now that we see, you know, his extremely powerful and influential orbit.
So talk to us about how they are feeling, these two clients that you've described. You know, obviously they have been victimized now twice, right? And in some ways, it's not, you know, I don't know the degree of pain, but it's got to be incredibly painful to go through this again when they have worked so hard to overcome. And many of them have not overcome. And I don't know if these two, but obviously, you know, we've covered the story and we've talked to lots of survivors, and that's not something you just overcome. How hard is it to have this all, you know, dragged up again against their wishes?
It's extremely hard. It's re-victimizing, you know, for lack of a better word. I mean, it has been so traumatic in them. And again, it's important to remember that this is unfortunately nothing new for the survivors of Jeffrey Epstein. They have been wronged every step of the way since the 90s, ignored every step of the way since the 90s. Every time they think they're going to get some modicum of justice, the, you know, the rug is pulled out from under them. We had, the 90s, the FBI ignored, you know, credible reports. In 2008, Alex Acosta gave him a sweetheart deal. In 2019, he was allowed to kill himself in federal custody. And then Ghislaine Maxwell was finally, you know, the one person was finally convicted, and now she's in a, you know, minimum security resort style prison. So it seems like every time they're close to justice, it's taken away, you know, 3 steps forward, 10 steps back. So unfortunately, it's nothing new, but they continue to fight, which is so inspiring and so remarkable. And they're not giving it up. And, you know, certainly, you know, those of us like myself who support them are not giving up.
So with regard to the work that you're doing on behalf of your clients, what did we learn from this latest document release?
So, I mean, we learned a lot. Now, there's plenty to say about the deficiencies and how it was released and the incompetency and how things were redacted. But there is a lot of information in there. I think one thing you can see, one thing I think a lot of people always sort of assume, but now you get to see it, is how influential and powerful the circle Jeffrey Epstein kept was. He had a very, very big circle of very powerful, influential people, billionaires across the world. I also think it's important to notice like how flippantly and how brazen Epstein and his, you know, in his cohorts, if you will, spoke about these women just as if they would never get caught, very openly, freely talking about, you know, the Russian or this woman or the young one, the Ukrainian. I mean, just the way they treated women as just such objects or currency even is really gross. And I just think also the breadth of how much of the abuse. I mean, how much time he spent, you know, how many people he was constantly in contact with, just sort of the breadth of his circle, the influence he had, and how much he was constantly talking about women and victims and how much he was surrounded by them. It's really gross. And hopefully the public sees, you know, really the scope of Epstein's circle and the scope of his abuse.
And what legal recourse are you seeking on behalf of your clients, and how will this discovery assist that?
you know, we're still sort of pouring through the files and, you know, trying to figure out what's what. We have filed, you know, we have been filing lawsuits. Of course, we filed lawsuits against the Epstein estate and JP Morgan, and we're continuing to file lawsuits against certain, explore lawsuits against government agencies, whether it's the FBI, the DOJ for what's happened here or past, you know, misgivings. You know, we're certainly exploring all angles. I have seen some accountability on behalf of some of these, you know, people who have been named in the Epstein files. And I think that's appropriate. I think if you were associating with Jeffrey Epstein closely after he was a publicly registered sex offender, there are certainly some questions asked. So we're still looking through the files. We're still exploring our options, you know, legally as to what we can bring and what we can continue to pursue, whether it's, you know, suing, you know, this government department for this, suing that government department for that, suing other individuals. Everything's on the table right now. And I think the one thing that's for sure is that, you know, we're not stopping here. You know, I think the Trump administration, the DOJ is hoping to look at this like the end of the story. You know, for us, this is really just the beginning.
Your point from the White, from the Oval Office last week, President Trump, who of course now has been named many times in the Epstein files. His photo has been released as being involved in the Epstein files, said from the White House that isn't it time to move on? Don't the American people want to focus and want me to focus on more important things? He famously got mad at a CNN reporter for not smiling when he was asking about the Epstein victims. Yeah. What's your take on that? And also, what's your client's takes on how, not surprisingly, he responded to that issue?
Yeah, certainly not surprising, but no, nonetheless, you know, still re-victimizing, still traumatic, you know, still, you know, sad for the survivors. You know, also, my understanding is the government, the United States federal government, is able to handle more than one thing at a time. You know, we don't have to drop the Epstein files because something else in the world or in the United States is happening. I mean, it's all this one or the other thing is just such nonsense to me. So, yeah, certainly there's plenty of important issues in this country that need to be tackled, but that doesn't mean that the survivors once again need to be disregarded. This story is not going away. I can assure you they're not going away. They are going to continue to fight for justice. We're going to continue to fight, you know, for them until every single document is released unredacted other than the victims' names, and every single person who facilitated or co-abused with Jeffrey Epstein is held accountable.
Well, I just want to just finish up with that last point because, you know, to show you what a load of BS all this is, the government has been saying that the delay, remember, there's a federal law that they violated by not releasing these documents right. Timely. The whole reason they said that they were delayed was because they had to redact the victims' names and to protect the victims. Yet they released it with, to your point, just one person over 500 times. So what was the delay? I mean, how incompetent can you be if the reason you stated was the delay was to redact the victims' names? And then just with one person, you don't redact it 500 times. I mean, does anyone think this is strange? Is it just me?
That's certainly not just you. I agree. I mean, I've been banging my hands on the table for months about the DOJ and how they've been handling this. And, you know, it's important to remember also, we didn't need a law. Like, a law was not necessary for the DOJ to release these documents. The only reason we had to come up with a law was because the administration, you know, did a 180 on their desire to release the files and just sort of tried ignoring it. So we had to get a law. Now there's a law. They violated the law, and their excuse for violating the law, like you said, is it's nonsense because I mean, literally, what were they doing? And this is not, it's important, like, I don't know how much the public understands, like, what redacting is, but it is a simple function of every law firm, every lawyer, every legal entity in the entire world. It is as easy as, like, a search and, you know, cross out on the, I mean, AI can do it, like, Word Perfect could do it in the 90s. Like, this All right. is not a rocket science. This is a very simple task to redact documents. It doesn't even matter if it's millions, 3 million, you know, 20 million. They're not the first person, they're not the first entity to have to deal with voluminous documents. It's something lawyers do every day. And, you know, it's something, you know, it's a just like literally the most basic function of providing documents, you know, in the legal world. So the fact that they needed an extra month and a half to do this and then just fail, you know, fell flat on their face failure and redacted the documents is just, it's mind boggling. It's suspicious. It's, you know, you know, put your name, you know, name it. It's just, it doesn't make any sense to me. And it's not okay. I mean, that's the more important point. It's not acceptable, and we're not going to accept it. We're going to continue to fight until this is done correctly.
Just about as believable as that a random staffer released that Obama video a few nights ago.
Sure.
Eric Fudali, thanks so much for joining us on Legal Face Off.
Thanks for having me.
Don't forget to listen, like, and subscribe to the Legal Face-Off podcast on social media and WGNradio.com. Well, the saga of Duke quarterback Darian Mensah has apparently come to a close. We've discussed this topic before in the Wild West known as the college sports scene. Mitch Gilfillan is a trial litigator with experience representing Illinois clients in personal injury, medical malpractice defense, family-related matters, business litigation, and sports management. That works out well for us. Mitch, thanks so much for coming on with us.
Yes, thanks, guys, for having me. Appreciate it.
So, Mitch, last month, outgoing Duke quarterback Darian Mensah reached a settlement with Duke, enabling him to enroll at Miami. Mensah had signed a two-year NIL deal with Duke in December of 2024, paying a reported $4 million a year. The lawsuit was triggered after Mensah told the school that he intended to transfer on the final day of the transfer portal window. Can you tell us more about this case?
Yes, no, this has certainly been a hot topic the last couple of months on what's going on with the never-ending sports battles across America. You know, this case really represented the perfect intersection of NIL, the transfer portal, and really for us attorneys, basic contract law. You know, Darian Mensah was a star-studded quarterback from Duke University, came from Tulane, entered into a two-year deal, like you said, and really it came down to the 11th hour with the transfer portal essentially closing, him saying he wanting to opt out of this NIL agreement, leaving Duke in the dust. And obviously, this was a very, very significant decision because of what the ramifications, both monetarily and really just for procedurally, how this would play out. You know, NIL agreements are really becoming the norm for the Power Four conference level type teams. And when players opt to leave or to at least breach those contracts, as this school alleges he did, that can have serious consequences to it. And so this case obviously took quite a spiral given the timing and the leverage involved. I do think, as we expected, as most cases do, the settlement was behind closed doors, but obviously a lot of it played out publicly.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be interesting to know what Miami paid Duke. I mean, they definitely paid something to Duke to reimburse what Duke suffered in damages. But what, you know, what's really interesting is, you know, and to your point, this is like one of the early cases, but to what degree is the school liable, and to what degree did Mensah contract with Duke for his NIL, even if he went somewhere else? I mean, technically, right, all he agreed to was to give his NIL rights to Duke, not to play for Duke. Conceivably, he could have abided by the contract by letting Duke use his NIL as a Hurricane, right? So, I mean, that's a little strange, but that's technically what he did, right? I mean, that's technically what was involved here.
Correct. I mean, it came down to more so a licensing agreement than the pay for play, so to speak, that's really going on behind the scenes in all of this that the NCAA doesn't want to fully acknowledge, because it's really at a crossroads with how these players are being paid, both through revenue share and through NIL, which are two different streams of income. And so you're right. I mean, Duke had no choice but to take action. I mean, this contract was actually attached as an exhibit to the lawsuit. Which is kind of unique in a situation like this to really air it out publicly on what's going on here. And Duke ultimately, you know, filed a temporary restraining order, preliminary injunction to get this before a judge as soon as possible before they suffered further damage, as they alleged to do. You know, you can argue all day on the contract principles of all of this, but for Duke, this was really priceless. This was their star quarterback heading into next year, coming off of an ACC championship. And now with the transfer portal closing and really the top market, top caliber quarterbacks all gone, this impacted them. And what the settlement ultimately was, you know, we don't know for sure, but there's no doubt in my mind, like you said, Miami had to pay something through liquidated damages, through a buyback, you know, a buyout clause, whatever it may be. There had to be some level of clawback that was going to compensate Duke appropriately for what happened, because it was significant.
So, Mitch, you know, Duke was successful in getting a TRO in several aspects of this case. So can you tell us a little bit about that? And also, just again, as you said, this was a very aggressive stance to take, not much of a choice here. Generally, it's schools that are getting sued. But, you know, this, I think, is the first case where an individual player got sued. So if you can, you know, walk us through that, too. I mean, obviously, we understand why you go after an individual player and not just the school. But it seems like there may be risks in doing so in these types of situations, too.
Yeah, no question. I mean, the temporary restraining order was a significant legal win for Duke because it required the court to act. You know, they didn't end up winning the war, you know, kind of use a cliche, but they certainly won the initial battle by getting some sort of payout, some sort of settlement from this, as opposed to be, you know, literally in the dust, like I said earlier, looking for some sort of compensation or some sort of value for this. You know, to your point, historically, you're right. You know, schools have preferred to sue other institutions, whether it's for tortious interference of business practice or some allegation of breach of contract to a collective tied with the university. Rarely do you go after the individual player. And now we're starting to see this more play out. The Washington quarterback that happened shortly before the Duke quarterback's lawsuit, and now obviously the Duke player. And so I think there's a strategic advantage of going after the player directly, but it also comes with some risk. Because again, stepping back, when you're a college coach, it can bring institutional harm, both from a recruiting standpoint and really from just a what are we valuing here? Are we really going to sue and go after our former players who decide to leave us? You know, I spent 6 years coaching in the Division I level at college basketball. And so I know firsthand just exactly what these coaches are going through when you invest time, energy, commitment to a recruit, and then they leave you. And obviously it's a different time now with NIL in play, with revenue share play, that there's monetary numbers here that are substantial, that people, if they really knew some of the details going on with some of these contracts, would be mind blown. And so you certainly felt for Duke in this situation, but obviously the player is going to do what's best for them. And there's no doubt the power has shifted these last 5 years from schools to the student athlete.
As you talk about the money involved here, you know, and again, we don't know the settlement amount. We don't know who paid it, if Mensa paid some of it or if Miami paid, you know, some of it. But I actually think whatever they paid, they probably got off light, right? I mean, if the contract was 2 years, $8 million, that's a fraction of the value of a star quarterback returning to the number two team in the country. After all, Miami lost the national championship, right? So they were the second best team in the country. We saw how a single individual, a quarterback, could change an entire, not only program, but school with Indiana. Look no further than Miami's opponent. And they got Fernando Mendoza. He won the Heisman, undefeated season, went on to win the national championship, will be the number one pick of the Raiders. That has changed Indiana forever in ways that you could not calculate. To your point, it's easier to recruit. It's harder to recruit for Duke now that they are known to lose a player. You know, Indiana will make millions, if not billions of dollars over the next 25 years as a result of this. That's not an exaggeration. So whatever they paid, if it was like a half of the contract, that's really not compensating Duke as someone who is in the business of trying to get compensation, you know, and calculate damages. That's not enough, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, what is the appropriate price tag for a loss such as this? And really, it's impossible to quantify. Because you said it best, you know, you look ahead to Duke next year, they probably could have been preseason top 10 or top 25 in America with a quarterback like that coming back. And those Saturdays to college athletic departments and the university, not just the athletic budget, but to the university itself, is astronomical what you can bring in on a college football Saturday when your team is really good. And sometimes that one Saturday alone can cover the costs and expenses of five separate sports for the year. Right. You know, that's why it's so impactful that when these decisions are made, they're not taken lightly, which is why Duke was forced to file that temporary restraining order and act.
So Mitch, where do you think this is all heading? I mean, there's obviously some very interesting issues, a lot of layers to these agreements. Some say that, you know, there's questions about just the general enforceability of these contracts. Are they really marketing arrangements? Are they employment agreements? Are they in effect non-competes? You know, as we're watching this landscape evolve pretty quickly, where do you think we're heading with all of this?
Yeah, I mean, I think at the core of it, the contract still has to have teeth to it. And, you know, in an interview I gave a couple weeks ago, I mentioned that as well, that this actually favored Duke because a contract was signed. They had to get something out of it. They didn't get the ultimate prize, which is the quarterback to stay, but you have to still have teeth to these contracts or otherwise it's pointless. You know, why even have contract law as it is? But, you know, to your point about NIL contracts, effectively, are they non-competes? You know, NIL, I think NIL contracts and agreements can function as non-competes, not by their labels, but more so by the practical effect that they're having on schools and obviously the student athlete. You know, courts, as we know, look to form compared to substance. And when an agreement conditions itself on a significant compensation on continued enrollment or athletic participation while imposing certain clawbacks or other financial entanglements, it can operate as a restraint on trade or labor, an athletic labor in a case like this. And so I think that, you know, analyzing the traditional non-compete analysis, we talk about scope or duration, or exactly what the purpose of the actual task is. And many NIL deals actually do have those exact same requirements. And so while they can technically function like that, they're just not labeled it. You know, I think legally you have to ask yourself, what are the remedies here? You know, what happens when these things happen in the future? Because it's not going to happen unless there's, you know, congressional intervention, which is not appear to be anytime soon. I think courts are deeply skeptical of injunctive relief that blocks an athlete from ultimately moving. And that's why this case ultimately led to a settlement, because how can you have a quarterback come back and play for you who says, I want to leave? And obviously it's the elephant in the room, is the conundrum that everybody's dealing with, is like, how do you keep somebody here that doesn't want to be here? And I think that's where reasonable minds have to come together and look for the best way out possible, which usually results in a settlement.
Mitch, last question. Do you think that this lawsuit and the settlement will influence the NCAA to put some rules? I mean, they are woefully inadequate. What, you know, there are no rules, basically, to your earlier point. There's some legislation pending, but what is the response, if any, to be to put some rules in place to govern this going forward?
Well, I think this Duke lawsuit certainly highlights areas where definite concern is being addressed across the country, and leaders are coming forward that there's got to be a more clear path forward. You know, having worked in the NCAA as a member institution for several years, and being a former Division I student athlete, I do sympathize sometimes with the NCAA because they're also at the mercy of their membership schools. The membership schools are the ones that put these bylaws into effect and ultimately vote on them. So you got to have some sort of cohesiveness here with the universities. That can be the presidents, that can be the conferences, that can be everybody that needs a seat at this table to come to some sort of resolution on where this is going to go. Because obviously you're going to continue to see more lawsuits like this with this much money involved.
Mitch Gilfillan, thank you so much. Really appreciate the conversation.
Thank you guys for having me.
Welcome back to Legal Face Off on WGN. It's time for the legal grab bag. But first, you know, we kind of blew through it in the opening. Tina has a new title. Tell us a little bit about what's going on there.
Yeah. So a couple of weeks ago, I, along with some of my partners at McDermott, left to launch the Chicago office of the law firm Deckert, which is an international firm. That started 150 years ago in Philadelphia. We're really excited about it. We wish our friends at McDermott all the best, and we miss them. But this is a really exciting turn of the chapter for a number of us. So super excited launching the Chicago office as well as Dallas. And I also took on the role of the global co-chair of the IP practice. So very excited about it.
Very good. And so you'll hear a little bit of a new intro for Tina, but still very much a part of Legal Face-Off, and very excited about that. So.
Thank you.
All right. Well, he's back. Sanford Williams, lecturer with UCLA Law, Vice President of Strategic Initiatives and Deputy General Counsel at Somos, joining us again on Legal Face-Off. Just so you know, Sanford, you do not get a jacket for your fifth appearance.
SNL does.
I think you have to hit like seven for that. I don't know. Okay. I still have not seen a jacket. So there you go.
Right, I'm coming.
In this corner, I have Lisa Saul, partner and chair of the real estate practice at Ford and O'Meara. Thank you so much, Lisa, for
coming. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. All right. The Treasury Secretary says American citizens will have to foot a bill for $10 billion in damages to be paid to President Trump and his two oldest sons if a court rules in their favor in a suit against the IRS. Rich, get us started with Trump Watch.
There's so many words you said are just bewildering, right? And again, this stuff gets lost in the daily nonsense that we have coming out of the White House. You know, I mean, it's hard to believe that the Obama, you know, meme is something that the sitting president of the United States released and then assumed that we would believe his nonsense, that it was a staffer. And like that was a couple days, but this kind of got lost in that and some of the other, again, nonsense coming out of the White House. And you know, what got a lot of attention out of this hearing, Tina, that Scott Bessent had on Capitol Hill was not this what we're about to talk about, but the exchange he had with some Congress people, members of the panel, including Maxine Waters. There was a shouting match. But what we're dealing with here is the president is suing the IRS, which is, you know, a government agency that he
leads. He's been very, very clear in saying that he leads all government agencies, right? As the head of the executive, he's suing the IRS and the Treasury Department for the leak of his tax returns to the New York Times. Forget the fact for a second that that revealed that he paid $750 in taxes over the course of 2 years. It was, and he filed the suit right before the statute of limitations ran. And, you know, Scott Bessent was asked, well, who would pay the bill if he wins? And you know, he said, well, yes, it would be the taxpayers, the Treasury. The $10 billion that he would pay would be from the taxpayers. And, of course, Trump has said, well, if I win, if I get this money, it's going to charity. I don't know, as if he gets to decide how $10 billion, what charity that goes to. And that's okay, as if that's okay. And, you know, like, it would be Bessent and the IRS who would decide basically whether they should pay it or settle it. And what are they going to do? They're his boss and they're lapdogs to him. So it's just like this bizarre world of suing, you know, an IRS. Now, of course, he says he was the IRS under his predecessor, was corrupt and all this, but just completely crazy bananas, right? And that we should foot the bill for this and trust that it's going to go to the right charity. What's going on? What's your take on this?
I mean, it is really, really weird. It's like the theater of the absurd. I mean, I think not that this would necessarily solve everything, but why not sort of toll the statute of limitations while he's in office? So that, I mean, it's a weird situation, but I think that would probably lead to a better result. Wait until he's out of office before he pursues this, because of the exact issue that you just described.
Now, Lisa, the alleged harm was in fact experienced by the plaintiff, by Trump, when he was out of office. Every citizen, even including the president, has the right to pursue, you know, their legal means of recourse. But come on, right? I mean, just come on.
I mean, he's the plaintiff and the boss of these parties. I mean, if this, Tina, I love your idea. If this is going to be pursued while he's in office, I don't know how they would do it without either appointing a special counsel, an independent party to oversee this whole process for it to be fair.
And Sanford, he's not just the plaintiff. I mean, he's both the plaintiff and the defendant. Remember, Trump has gone to extremes in saying, I am the chief executive officer of the executive branch, and everyone below me is subject to my decisions, including firing people like that are way down the chain. If that's the case, then he's also the defendant in this case, right?
Right. And first, congratulations, Tina, on your new position. But I worked at the FCC for almost 26 years and left recently. And one of the things that we've seen is that he is using the levers of government, because he says, I'm the boss of everything. So you can't simultaneously be the boss of everything and also be the judge and the executioner and all that jazz. So I think that Tina's point and his point are totally on point. It doesn't make any sense.
All right, let's roll on to the next topic here. Don Lemon arrested for his alleged involvement in that Minnesota church protest. But what does the law say about that arrest? Tina, you threw this into the bag for us.
Yeah, Ryan. So this is an interesting one. So as we all know, journalist Don Lemon, you know, he was on Kimmel a few days ago. He said about a dozen federal agents came to his Los Angeles hotel to arrest him the week before last over federal civil rights charges relating to his coverage of an anti-immigration enforcement protest that disrupted a church service at a Minnesota church. The grand jury in Minnesota indicted him, as well as another independent journalist, Georgia Ford, and others on charges of conspiracy and interfering with the First Amendment rights of worshipers during that January 18th protest. So what's interesting is that, you know, as we all heard and maybe saw in Kimmel, he said that he went there as a journalist. He went there to chronicle and document and record what was happening. He said he was following the group around, and that's what he did, and he was reporting it. So there are a number of interesting legal issues that arise out of this, particularly there were some differing accounts of what happened that day as the protesters entered the church. First Amendment does protect individuals from government punishment for lawful expression. Those rights, as we know and we've discussed on the show, tend to be strongest when they are in what we call traditional public forums, such as sidewalks, streets, and parks. But when we're talking about entering private property, and a church or a house of worship is considered private property, and when they disrupt religious services, which is what the allegation is here, that's when certain rights could potentially curtail those First Amendment rights. So, for example, we've got issues of potential trespass. We've got issues relating to what's called FACES, which is a federal law, and its name is Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances Act, which is often used in the context of reproductive health facilities, Rich. But here it's being used in the context of religious services. Ignorance of the law is not generally weighed at all. And in this instance, while the First Amendment is obviously, you know, alive and well, when we're talking about the circumstances here, Rich, that's where it starts to get a bit muddier.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think it's that muddy. I think it's more nonsense, right? I mean, I think it's just an example of locking up journalists, trying to send a chill on the First Amendment of reporters that he doesn't like. We all saw the video. It's another example of the White House trying to convince us to not see what our eyes show us, right? I mean, our eyes looked at the video. The video is Don Lemon interviewing people. And he clearly says the words, "I am not a protester. I am a journalist." I mean, what more do you need? If it's unclear, shouldn't the benefit of the doubt go to a journalist? And, you know, they're calling him not a journalist. I mean, Don Lemon was a journalist on CNN for years and years. He's now an independent journalist. This White House gives a seat in the Brady briefing room to all sorts of fringe people. They give a special seat to what they call new media. Those are people who are barely journalists. They're, you know, fringe people. And yet Don Lemon, with his career record, is not a journalist. By the way, number two, it's also one of those, it's just blatant racism. Let's call it what it is. Don Lemon's black. The other journalist that they, you know, went after is black, a black woman. Last week, he went after Caitlin Collins for not smiling while asking about sexual abuse victims of Jeffrey Epstein. Like, think about it. When's the last time that Trump went after a white male journalist? Can you think of any examples? I mean, you know, I remember back in the first term, he went after George Ramos from Univision, a Hispanic journalist. I mean, just call it what it is. It's like, it's just, it's a way to go after journalists. It's a way to curb the First Amendment, and it's a way to further show your racism. Sanford, what are your thoughts?
I concur with everything you said. I would add that it's kind of analogous to the government announcing last week they're going to go after The View for having Tyler Rico on their show because they're not adhering to the policies of equal representation. And these things do chill folks because people do get scared by them. So I think they're using the bully pulpit, so to speak, to scare folks and chill folks. And it's unfortunate.
Lisa, what's your thoughts?
No, I mean, I agree with everything you're all saying. This brought me back to my religion and law class at Georgetown, which I actually really liked that class. But, you know, Tina, when I'm thinking about what you're saying, you're right. You can't enter a place of worship and, you know, knowingly disrupt that place of worship. There's, you know, many, many cases that prove that. Here, you know, we're not really sure of the motive of why this is happening. So I know there's a lot of nuances and, you know, I'll leave it at that.
Point of
correction. I'm just reporting here. I'm not saying, I'm not advocating for either side, guys. I'm just reporting what the issues are.
Point of correction, Rich. He got a federal court judge to sign off on it, right? So, I mean, there's something to it.
And point of correction, Rich. Trump has gone after George Slavidopoulos. Remember that? So he did go after one white reporter, reporter, Slavidopoulos.
You mean Stephanopoulos?
That's what he called him.
Exactly. Right. All right. Good point.
Moving on. Condé Nast is suing a small Beverly Hills dog publisher, allegedly for trademark infringement, among other things. Rich, what's going on with this story?
Yeah, I mean, maybe we're putting Lisa on the spot, but maybe we could pull up the cover here.
I want to read this magazine.
Yeah, it's there we go. It's a magazine called Dog, I guess, not to be confused with Doge, the failed attempt by Elon Musk to remedy some government inefficiencies. But there's Dog with a nice version of Yoda on there. And then that's not to be confused, hopefully, with Vogue. But Vogue is very protective, as is their parent company, Tina. Condé Nast, one of the, you know, if I think the largest magazine publisher in the world. On December 5th, Vogue, Condé Nast filed a federal lawsuit against Dog's publisher, Tastywork LLC, alleging trademark infringement. trademark dilution and unfair competition, saying that this was not unintentional, this was deliberate, and that the title is nearly identical to Vogue, and it was obviously intended to mislead consumers and to make consumers think that there was an affiliation between Dogue and Condé Nast. Tina, this is your expertise. Break this down for us.
Yeah.
Well, so, is it fair to think that consumers would confuse a magazine showing a dog with Vogue, which obviously doesn't cover canines?
You know, this is a really interesting one, and I have not done a lot of research on this, but my initial impression is, as somebody who works with a lot of different clients, if you don't go after this, then, you know, I mean, like, they have to go after this.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, it's interesting. There's the trademark, straight up trademark infringement, which is an allegation that there's a likelihood of confusion. The dilution claim is not the same as a trademark infringement claim. They essentially, it's a claim that the mark Vogue is so famous as to either this use, you can cause dilution by blurring or by tarnishment. I'm not sure which they're alleging here, but the blurring means that you're essentially whittling away the fame of the mark by having another brand like this that's so close. By tarnishment means that you are somehow disparaging or tarnishing the brand by use of a brand like this. You know, some people look at this and say, ha ha, I'm laughing at this, therefore it's a parody. But the parody analysis is really very complicated. There usually has to be some sort of a statement that you're making that is at the heart of the parody. When it's a commercial type of use, it's usually subject to a lot more scrutiny than something where there isn't a commercial aspect to it. These guys also, in addition to putting it on magazines, they filed a trademark application for it. So, I mean, I have to say, I mean, my initial impression is I think they had to do this, and I don't blame them. I don't like it. And I'm not seeing where the parody is, especially when they're commercializing it the way they are.
Yeah. And Lisa, I think, you know, in this case, you know, we often cover cases like this where there might be two grocery store products and they look exactly the same, you know, very similar, and the wording is similar. And there's a legitimate concern that a consumer would think that the cheaper product is, you know, they're buying the more expensive product. In this case, I don't think that argument is as strong as what Tina said, which is like, you are profiting from the, you know, decades old brand that is Vogue, right? I mean, they are producing this dog magazine to be kind of an upscale, and just the photography and the whole look of it, there's no question that is supposed to, you know, make profit off the brand that is Vogue.
They're 100% piggybacking off of Vogue and using those,
right,
the many years. And I also read that they're using celebrities now. They're showing celebrities and their dogs, which, I mean, truthfully, there could be some confusion going on there. I mean, Vogue isn't upscale. They profile celebrities too. So I think Condé Nast has no choice in this case but to try to shut it down.
Stanford,
well,
do you have
like to read the magazine.
Stanford, do you have a dog, and is it appropriate to, would they be appropriate for the cover of Dogue?
Well, I have three kids and three grandkids, and that's enough for me. But I will add that the first thing I thought of was Coming to America, where they had McDowell's restaurant.
Yes,
you know,
McDowell's.
Obviously, in front of McDonald's, it's obvious that they're trying to, you know, piggyback off Vogue.
Yeah,
there might be an opportunity for why doesn't Vogue just buy out Dogue, and then they could do it, right? Do the same thing. All right. Kind of a weird story. One of the people called to testify in the federal tax evasion trial of SCOTUS Blog co-founder Tom Goldstein is actor Toby Maguire. Rich, what's going on here?
And Goldstein is very well known. He is the founder of SCOTUS Blog, something that we've referenced many times in our 11 years. And, you know, it's alleged that Toby Maguire testified in this case because it's alleged that Goldstein is a poker player, and he ran up a lot of debt, and he is being criminally prosecuted for tax evasion, for failure to pay taxes, and, you know, various other alleged crimes. And Toby Maguire came in and said that he had asked Goldstein to help pay off some of his debt to deal with this huge debt he had racked up. Tom McGuire is a very well-known poker player. He's been doing that for years. You know, I think what, you know, to our earlier point about lack of knowledge not being a defense in terms of the Tom Goldstein case, you know, one of his defenses in this case, Tina, is that, you know, I was unaware of some of the implications of some of the taxes I had to pay. I mean, this guy is one of the most well-known attorneys in the country and has been for years. And for him to try to convince the trier of fact in this case that he wasn't aware of the implications is not going to go very far, I think. But yeah, it was interesting to see Tobey Maguire come in and discuss. By all accounts, he was, you know, very matter of fact and very objective in his testimony.
Yeah, Rich, I mean, this is a really interesting case for a number of reasons, as you've profiled. I mean, first, I'm not sure if he's got any more of a defense other than what he said that he wasn't aware. I mean, and that doesn't even hold a lot of water. But, you know, as we've talked a lot about on this show, you know, Tobey Maguire, obviously very famous for a long time. It's important, you know, to just be mindful of who you sort of hang out with as a star, because, you know, you end up in situations like this where, I mean, I think from all accounts, his testimony was delivered in his most effective way possible, very matter of fact, you know, so that he looks like he's credible. But just a bigger, you know, bigger picture commentary of, as a star, you have to just be really careful who you hang out with, who you do business with, because you may end up in situations like this where when you're testifying in a situation like this, it doesn't help your renown to be in situations like this.
Stanford, I'm not clear if it's either through Tobey Maguire's testimony or this is part of the prosecution's case, but allegedly the payment, this $500,000 legal fee to help recover a $7 million poker debt. Apparently that was routed through a third party at the request of Goldstein rather than paid directly. That seems damning that he was, you know, familiar enough to sort of try to evade a paper trail.
Right. And you think that with his renown, he'd know that these are client funds and you should send it straight to the fund or to the attorney. Right. So I mean, he's obviously probably embarrassed and trying to keep it under wraps and hoping no one found out. Now everyone found out, but Spider-Man.
He got caught in a web, I suppose.
I was going to say that.
But. By the way, how...
You know, my alternative title, Ryan? You got to point out the title here. The title here was Great Power Comes Great Liability. My alternative was going to be from Uncle Ben to Uncle Sam.
By the way, how old do you guys think Tobey Maguire is? Just guess real quick.
Early 50s.
He still looks like he's...
48.
He is.
I'm going to say 56.
He is 50 years old. I wouldn't have figured he'd be 50, but
he was seen over the weekend at a Super Bowl party, partying with Leo.
Fantastic! That's who I'd want to be partying with. All right, football's over. Sanford's got the trophy. He swiped it. I see in the background there in San Francisco, you know, we can talk about San Francisco Giants baseball apparently. And Tina, apparently, there's allegations that they've been hiding ticket fees.
Yeah, Ryan. So we're seeing more of this. At the end of last month, San Francisco Giants fan Juan Flores filed a proposed class action lawsuit against the team, alleging that when he bought two tickets to a game against the San Diego Padres in April of 2024, the online form that he filled out listed the price as $10 per ticket, but that when he showed up at the ballpark, he was charged essentially another $10 each for convenience fees and order processing fees. These are often called junk fees, and he alleges that these were charged to hundreds of thousands of advance ticket purchasers before the Giants stopped charging these fees in July of 2024, which was apparently in response to a newly enacted California law. Flores alleges that they also violate false advertising and unfair competition laws and is seeking repayments to past ticket buyers and additional damages for an unspecified amount. According to the lawsuit, the federal government has estimated that these sort of junk fees cost U.S. consumers more than $90 billion a year. In response to the Flores lawsuit, the Giants issued a general statement that it did not go into details, but it says that the team's policies as a general matter demonstrate their commitment to transparency and to following the law. Other lawsuits of this type include the Washington Nationals and the Boston Red Sox, who in the last several months have likewise been accused by their fans who have purchased tickets of violating state consumer protection laws, Rich.
A lot wrapped up in this. I mean, you know, a couple weeks ago, my daughter demanded that I immediately give her my credit card security code to get online to buy Harry Styles tickets. We've covered, I mean, the Harry Styles thing is crazy. I mean, people are selling their blood literally to buy Harry Styles tickets. She was lucky enough to get in on one of the shows. But I mean, this is something we've, you know, we've been facing for 35 years, right? This idea that the market for ticket sales. On the one hand, you know, my free market side says, whatever, charge as much as you can get. There is a market for this. And if there's fees rolled in, that is the market. And if the market didn't support it, Lisa, then they wouldn't have them. I mean, there is a massive, massive demand for these events. Ariana Grande is coming. That's also a huge ticket. You know, the Taylor Swift Eras Tour just, you know, made record sales. Super Bowl just concluded yesterday, although the ticket prices were down. When I looked yesterday, the ticket prices were considerably cheaper than they have been in the past. But, you know, why shouldn't these companies charge everything they can? And, you know, they don't have to be transparent about it. I mean, we don't ask, for example, how much profit a restaurant makes when we go order a salad. We don't ask them to break down what their charges are. They're making a profit, and there's lots of fees built in there. Why do we demand that out of ticket companies?
I mean, I don't disagree with anything you're saying. However, I do think, you know, the deception's a little bit confusing. And if people are going to buy tickets, they should know all the fees up front. Just charge whatever you want, but put all the fees in there, like even they do, even how they do on some resale sites now, you know, all fees and everything included. To me, that would be the answer. Agree. Charge whatever you want, but just make it transparent for everyone who's buying tickets.
I believe Kid Rock just testified about that, correct? Last week before Congress about all the Ticketmaster and Live Nation stuff.
But it's always the people who aren't in demand. The right. Kid Rock is not making the money that these people are making. Of course he's going to testify. If he was selling out MSG for 30 nights, he wouldn't be testifying, I promise you.
I have to ask you, Rich, why don't you give Nia your card? My daughter Nia, who Rich knows well, met her same watermelon sugar, actually.
Same oh my God, that's so true.
The next time I'm going to let her call you.
Well, wait, she was singing her original response song to Watermelon Sugar, which is incredible. Yes. Yeah, everyone should check it out. Give us quickly her Instagram, if you have it in front of you.
I believe it's at Nia CC, N-I-A-C-C, but it's Nia CC Williams is her name.
Nia is the best.
And Rich, what is that credit card code? I got World Cup tickets I need to get. Can you pass that along?
000.
Got it. All right. Thanks. All right. Let's stick in the sports world. A Detroit Lions fan who was punched in the face by Pittsburgh Steelers wide receiver DK Metcalf is now suing for $100 million.
Wait, he was not punched. That's the whole point, right? I mean, he was. I mean, we saw again. We're being asked to unsee what is seen on video. I mean, DK Metcalf has this game. Who plays for the Steelers? He's a wide receiver, and he came over. And I mean, I don't know. Maybe because you're right. The story does say he was punched. That's what he's alleging. But I don't know. I've watched the video many times. He wasn't punched, was he, Sanford? I mean,
I didn't see the
connection. Yeah,
there was I don't see it either.
No, so he wasn't punched, first of all. But even if he and again, he's not suing for personal injury. If he was punched, that would be one thing. He's suing for defamation. Now, he's asking for $100 million against Metcalf and some others, including Shannon Sharp, saying that he was defamed. And the central part of this is that he was accused of using the N-word, a racial slur, against Metcalf and another word towards Metcalf's mother. Now, Metcalf hasn't commented on this. The plaintiff has asked Metcalf to come out and admit that he didn't use a racial slur, that all he said was he used his actual birth name, which is DeKalin. And instead of calling him DK, he called him DeKalin, and that's why Metcalf responded. And he said, you know, what kind of reasonable person would in today's day and age in downtown Detroit use the N-word at a packed stadium? I don't know. I mean, but my take on it is someone who defends outrageous lawsuits every day with crazy claims of damages. We talked about damages earlier. $100 million? I mean,
even if DK Metcalf was the one alleging defamation, I don't think it'd be worth $100 million. But what did this guy do? He was like a regular guy, right? I was trying to figure out what he did for a living that puts the value of his reputation at $100 million. So I get it. There's deep pockets involved here, but stop it.
Yeah, I mean, I agree, Rich. It blows me away, the whole notion of $100 million in damages. But also, I mean, like when you, I mean, I saw the video of him with his lawyers, you know, doing the press conference, and the justification that was given by one of the lawyers, like who would say something like this in this day and age in Detroit? Well, with viral videos being what they are, we know that there are unfortunately a lot of people who would say these sorts of really offensive things. And I mean, they're just now being taken to task because there's video evidence of them saying the things they're saying. So, I mean, I just found it really weird that of all the things his lawyers could have said, that this is what they said. It was just very strange to me. The whole thing is just bizarre to me.
Yeah. Sanford, I'm sure you saw this video many times.
Yeah. I would say with the current, like Tina mentioned, in a time in our country, anything is possible, he said. So that's not a great defense. Hopefully he did not say that. I also think, though, that Metcalf, and hopefully he's learned his lesson, no matter what he said, he's going to refrain from doing that because he's going to come out looking bad and he got suspended for a game and hurt the Steelers down the stretch. So hopefully this gentleman is alleged, he said. But fan behavior has just gotten out of control. And who knows what's going to happen for the rest forward, but it's bad that the state of affairs that we're in with fans heckle players to that extent.
Lisa, the accuser in his initial press conference wore a Detroit Lions baseball cap, which is kind of a choice, but he wore it backwards. My advice to any litigant, if you want to be taken seriously,
totally agree.
Leave the backwards baseball cap in your attorney's office.
Leave the hat off altogether, but in my opinion. But yeah, I mean, when I first watched that video, I mean, I didn't see it. There was no punch there. I mean, I think the whole thing is just a little bit taken too far at this point.
All right, let's go to the Olympics. We've got some issues with figure skating music. First, it was whether a Spanish male figure skater, here we go, Tomas Lorenc Guarino Sabate. I think I nailed
very
it.
Very impressive.
Thank you.
That was really good.
By the way, be careful. I don't know if we can even say the word Olympics, but you know, we got to be careful.
This is a news story. It's a news story. All right, okay. we're fine. Could he skate to the Minions movie music? And apparently, heading into the weekend, he got the clearance. He got the thumbs up. What was very interesting is when Team USA figure skating had their press conference, Amber Glenn was asked specifically about it and said, "Oh, yeah, I've been following this story," and admitted she didn't know what any of the rules were. Now, a Canadian musician is saying, "Hey, wait a minute here. That song that you're using for your free skate," which, by the way, she's been using for the last 2 years. Yeah. I didn't give permission for her to use that. Is this, are we doing this now? Like the quotes are really interesting. He seemed to be very surprised that anyone would use his music to you know, participate in the Olympics. And really, she's been using it for 2 years.
Yeah. So, I mean, Ryan, yeah, I mean, you did a really great job of summarizing both of the situations. And apparently this is becoming more of an issue with the Olympics because they changed the rule a few years ago in terms of people using music, whether it's skating or, you know, doing gymnastics, that they used to use a lot of classical music, which was in the public domain. They would use versions of music where there wasn't singing, but then they changed the rule a few years ago and people could actually start using contemporary pieces where there are copyright issues at issue. And depending on who the artist is, it can be pretty difficult to get clearances. And if you're talking about a medley where you've got four or five different songs that are layered or, you know, splices of each are sort of melded together into a medley, that's where it can get really tricky. And with, you know, the male figure skater, Guarino Sabate, what happened with him was he started this process in August. And it just so happens that these things sometimes take time, depending on who has the rights and who you need to get permission from. Ultimately, yes, he got permission, and I think he's skating tomorrow. Amber Glenn, it was really interesting. Unfortunately, I think what's going on here is, first of all, you know, she said she wasn't aware of it. Second of all, I think it's unfortunate that people take issue with some of the things that she speaks out about. She's a very, you know, I would say vocal advocate for the LGBTQ plus community. And I don't like the possibility that people are trying to stop her from being an advocate, but there's been some speculation that that's what's going on. That being said, you cannot use somebody else's music in a performance without their permission. And it's just becoming more of an issue, Rich, now, because people are using contemporary music now where they didn't a few years ago.
I mean, you know, her response was that it's just a cash grab and it's not like we're a TV show and playing music. Like, who cares? You're using someone else's art and IP for your benefit, period. Get their permission. It's just a very simple concept. And the idea that it's all amateur, there's no such thing as amateur sports anymore. As we've talked about with NIL, the Olympics are a huge business and these athletes are making money off it, right? I mean, I keep seeing this bed commercial, right, with one of the athletes. I mean, they're making money and, you know, why should an artist, whether they're a big artist, small artist, Canadian, why should they have their art taken without their permission? It's crazy. Lisa Sanford.
Yeah, I agree on this. I couldn't figure out if the Canadian artist was asking Amber Glenn. First of all, I love figure skating. I was a figure skater my whole life. So this is the best time. Every 4 years, I get so excited. But I couldn't decide if they're asking her to do anything or stop using the music. It wasn't clear to me. I mean, he seems like a smaller artist. So you would think this would be like good recognition for him, in my opinion, a win-win for everyone. I mean, Amber Glenn.
Well, that's terrific, always the response is that, you know, that the artist should be happy that they're getting notoriety, but that's not enough. I mean, you know, that's not part of the bargain when you make art. You should get reimbursed for it, not just in terms of some vague notion of notoriety, in my opinion, Sanford.
Right. No, I agree. I'm having a daughter who's a musician. If her song makes it onto the Olympic stage, I'm going to be paid for it. So I agree with that. And I have to say, Rich, there are amateur sports. I have a 5-year-old, a 3-year-old, and a 3-year-old grandchildren. They play soccer shots or something like that. That's definitely amateur.
For sure. Hey, but I know your fat. Listen, I know your family. They're already being scouted for bigger things, for future UVA athletics, I know.
Yes.
You know, one thing that's interesting, though, is Alyssa Liu skates to Lady Gaga. That's allowed. But this guy from Canada.
She got permission to do it.
I mean, that's the power, I suppose, right? If you're Alyssa Liu, you've competed before. I don't know.
In the spirit of the games that are happening in Italy right now, I will just use that term. Let's go around the horn and learn a little bit about our guests and maybe talk about your favorite Olympian of all time. You could go current, you could go past. Let's start with Sanford Williams. Do you like the Olympics? Do you like the summer or the winter games? And who's your favorite Olympian?
Summer games for sure. Track and field, number one. And I have two. One, Magic Johnson, because he's my favorite basketball player ever.
Yes.
But the second is kind of self-interested, Jesse Owens. I know he's going to go very well with friends from, you know, your area. So he definitely beat tied. So Magic Johnson, my two favorite.
Good one. Lisa, favorite Olympian. Lisa.
I love the Winter Olympics. I love figure skating. Debbie Thomas is my favorite Olympian of all time. She was the figure skater when I was growing up. I had her all over my wall, and I still, no one comes close for me.
She was amazing. Tina.
So there's so many, but I have to say Nadia Comaneci for what she did for the sport. I mean, I just was a little kid when she was in the Olympics, and I was just mesmerized.
Montreal Games, 1976. Ryan Burrow, favorite Olympian of all time. You're an Olympian, Olympic aficionado of many ways, and veteran reporter of the Olympics. But tell us your favorite Olympian.
Yeah, I mean, it's Michael Jordan. No question about that, but that's the obvious one. That's lame. But I would say Apollo Ono beyond that. That was really got me into speed skating, and I really wish that I would have stuck with that. That would have been a lot of fun.
Apollo Ono was amazing. Lisa Stiegel, who is your favorite Olympian? Anyone from Indiana, perhaps?
No, Ryan just took mine. I gotta go with Nancy Kerrigan. I mean, how do you not like her after what she went through?
Tanya Harding.
That's my Nancy Kerrigan person. I got a ton, you know, as a Canadian gentleman, I have many. So I was actually, I don't want to date myself, but I was at the 1976 Olympics with a guy named Bruce Jenner. I saw the decathlon.
And that, at the time, the winner of the decathlon, as Sanford will back me up, was known as the greatest athlete on earth.
Yes.
And the now Caitlyn Jenner was Bruce Jenner back then and won the decathlon. I saw that in person. I have been to a couple of other Olympics, but I would say my answer is Sidney Crosby scored the most important goal in my country's history, the golden goal. So I'm going to go with Sid the Kid.
Mm-hmm. That'll be fun. We got the NHLers back this year. Where are you going to be on Sunday morning, February 22nd? Little kegs and eggs somewhere, Rich?
Yeah, I'll be watching bright and early my Canadian squad beat hopefully the Americans.
We'll see. I don't know. Americans are out for Canadian tears, I heard. All right. Thank you so much, Lisa Saul and Sanford Williams. That'll do it for this latest installment of Legal Face-Off on WGN. Special thanks to Eric Fudali with the Bloom Firm. We had Mitch Gilfillan with Quinn Johnston and David Ring with Taylor Ring. Also, shout out to Ben Anderson, Lisa Stegel for Tina Martini, Rich Lenkoff. I'm Ryan Burrow. Thanks again for joining us on Legal Face-Off on WGN.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Lenkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face-Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget.